2 Peter 3 warns that shortly before Jesus' return, people will belittle the Bible as never before. Mockers will denigrate the integrity of the Bible and call it untruthful. Perhaps no biblical account stirs their enmity more than Noah and the universal flood. Without a biblical worldview, mockers of the Bible use the account of Noah and a global flood as their proof the Bible is fable and therefore unreliable. They cite many supposed improbabilities to make their point. The flood story was copied from Babylonian literature. There's not enough water on earth to cover the 16,854-foot-high Mount Ararat, let alone the 29,029-foot-high summit of Mount Everest. Ancient man didn't possess the knowledge and technology to build a ship the size of the ark. How did Noah capture so many animals and get them into the ark? It wouldn't be possible to house and tend the thousands of animals, birds, and insects needed to preserve every species of creature that exists today. A loving God wouldn't destroy people and animals with a worldwide flood. Are the skeptics right? Is the account of Noah in a worldwide flood just allegory? Or are there logical counterpoints to explain every criticism of Noah and a global flood? I'm going to touch on answers to two arguments Bible skeptics make. Ancient man didn't possess the technology to build a ship the size of the ark, and there's not enough water on earth to cover the 16,854-foot-high Mount Ararat, let alone the 29,029-foot summit of Mount Everest. Did ancient man have the wherewithal to build an ark? That depends on your worldview. Last century, when I was in grade school, I received a healthy dose of secular worldview regarding the history of mankind. According to my teachers, the first humans lived in caves, having just lost their tails and having abandoned swinging from trees. They had no distinguishable language or alphabet. Their communication consisted of grunts, and they used clubs to subdue their fellow animals. Over tens of thousands of years, man advanced to the Stone Age, and then the Bronze Age, and into the Iron Age. Although taught with certainty, was what I learned in grade school an accurate description of man's history? Not according to the Bible. The Bible totally contradicts this secular worldview. Genesis 1 explains that man was created in God's image. Man didn't derive from apes or any other species of life. Genesis 2 shows the environment in which the first humans lived. Verse 8, the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. Any mention of caves? No. Verses 16 and 19 recognize the immediate language skills of Adam in how he was able to understand and respond to verbal instruction. God commanded the man in verse 16. Then verse 19 expands on how thoroughly the first man was fully equipped with language and communication skills. Out of the ground, the Lord formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he, Adam, would call them. And whatsoever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. Did it require tens of thousands of years before man learned how to grow crops? Genesis 2:9 says, no. Out of the ground, the Lord God made every tree grow that is pleasant to sight and good for food. The understanding of agriculture and husbandry were disciplines grasped and available to man from the first day of man's creation. what other competencies did Adam and his descendants possess? To name just a few, mining and metallurgy, Genesis 4:22. Zillah bore Tubal-Cain, who made all kinds of bronze and iron tools. Physics and architecture, Genesis 4:17b. Cain built a city. Mathematics and engineering, Genesis 6:15. This is how big I want you to build the boat, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. The first generations of humans were so intellectually advanced, Genesis 11:6 states, that nothing they set out to accomplish will be impossible for them. Perhaps the best evidence, proof, of ancient man's proficiency reflects in buildings found all around the world. Here are a few observations from the book, The Genius of Ancient Man. In ancient times, with such long lives and intelligent minds, the people made discoveries and advancements that present-day man does not yet understand. The author describes multiple sites from around the world that amaze and baffle researchers today. For example, Puma Punku in Bolivia, which shows the results of highly advanced stone cutting techniques. Many of the blocks strewn about Puma Punku are intricately cut and shaped, so they fit together like Lego pieces. Huge stone slabs, the largest being 120 tons, are thought to be quarried downhill 6 miles away. Smaller slabs of andesite were quarried 56 miles across Lake Titicaca. Many of these huge stones were cut with many sides at angles that fit each other perfectly, making an interlocking system that could withstand earthquakes in the area. The blocks show highly developed geometric patterns indicating technology much more advanced than later civilizations in the region. The sophisticated workmanship also includes elaborate drainage systems and well-engineered irrigation canals, as well as agricultural terraces. The people of Puma Punku were extremely clever and held many secrets that may never be discovered. In the concluding remarks of Chapter 8, Monuments, Mounds, Pyramids, the author wrote, "It is obvious that the ancient architects held some sort of knowledge that is unknown today. It's interesting that cultures able to build such magnificent structures are not often even credited with having a system of writing or scientific knowledge." Another excavation, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, also contradicts secular worldview regarding ancient man. From an article, 11 Impressive Photos of Göbekli Tepe, there's an archaeological site in present-day Turkey unlike anything we've ever found anywhere else in the world. There, about 12,000 years ago, a mysterious group of people, thought to have been hunter-gatherers, decided to build an intricate monument using multi-ton blocks of stone. By means we are still unable to comprehend, these mysterious people erected as many as 200 stone pillars in various walled circles. This ancient site's historical evidence asserts that the evolution of humanity at that time is just the opposite of what we thought. Contrary to popular belief, more than 12,000 years ago, people were sophisticated and organized enough to construct intricate ancient sites. They had enough knowledge that allowed them to develop tools and techniques that made it possible for them to quarry, transport, and put in position multi-ton stones. So, how does knowing about ancient architectural techniques help us answer the question, did ancient man possess the technology to build a ship the size of the Ark? unlike ancient buildings made from stone, evidence of which has survived over 40 centuries of weathering, the Ark was made of wood. Just because researchers today can't touch the Ark or examine it, does that automatically mean man couldn't have built it? Of course not. Ancient buildings prove that ancient man was proficient in many fields, as previously cited. Couldn't the same knowledge needed to design, cut, transport, and assemble multi-ton interlocking stones be used to design, cut, transport, and assemble wood for an ark? What is one of the greatest dangers faced by any ship, especially wooden ships? Leaks. Mockers of the Ark claim that Noah's Ark would never withstand the incessant movement of the waves. Why? Because water pressure would cause the Ark's planks to flex and move, thereby causing leaks. As an ancient man, was Noah too stupid to know that? What did we learn from Puma Punku? Carefully cut interlocking stones could withstand the forces of earthquakes. So wouldn't carefully cut interlocking planks withstand the forces of water? Here's a potential solution to leaks as posited by the Ark encounter. One problem with long wooden ships is that they tend to flex in the waves, causing planks to slide against each other and break waterproofing seals. The Ark Encounter model features three layers of structural planking plus two extra outer layers below the waterline to protect against scraping and collision. Strong ceiling timbers increase the strength of the hull and provide attachment points for the internal decks. The layers of planking are held together by a series of mortise and tenon joints. These joints interlock to prevent the planks from sliding and loosening. Did Noah understand such concepts? Apparently he did, for his ark survived the worst flood that ever occurred. Did ancient man possess the technology to build a ship the size of the ark? Yes. Although it's mentally challenging to speculate how the ark was built, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. Historians know the Greeks built a 425-foot-long ship, the Tesseronteros, and that the Chinese built treasure ships between 440 and 538 feet long by 210 feet wide. Remnants of none of those ships exist today. So why do people believe the Greek and Chinese ships existed, but the Ark didn't? Denial of the historicity of Noah in favor of the fallible ideas of man hurt those who think they're smarter than God, as Proverbs 9:12 observes. If you are wise, wisdom is its own reward. If you mock what you don't understand, you alone will suffer the consequences. In this case of denying that the ark never existed, one consequence is a life of spiritual darkness without God. How do we answer the mocker's contention that there's not enough water on Earth to cover the 16,854-foot-high Mount Ararat, let alone the 29,029-foot-high summit of Mount Everest? Those without a biblical worldview hold to the uniformitarian principle. Wikipedia defines uniformitarianism as the assumption that the same natural laws and processes that operate in our present-day scientific observations have always operated in the universe in the past. Those with a biblical worldview know that that's a faulty assumption. Did the present heights of Mount Ararat and Mount Everest exist during the days of Noah? No. What were the heights in the days of Noah? Unknown. How then did Earth's geography become what we see today? Let's answer that in two steps, starting with Genesis 7:19. From the Message, Genesis 7:19, the flood got worse until all the highest mountains were covered. The high water mark reached 20 feet above the crest of the mountains. Is there any proof that today's mountains were at one time covered by water? Actually, there's ample proof, and here are a couple of examples. What is the highest mountain in Colorado? It's Mount Elbert at 14,440 feet. According to the article Noah's Flood, Fact or Fiction, the fossil on screen was found near the top of Mount Elbert. Is a marine fossil on top of a high mountain an anomaly? No. Here are a few sentences from Fish Fossils on Mountains Against Slow Evolution. The opening sentence is, scientists have found fossils of whales, fish, shellfish, and other marine animals in mountains, such as in the Andes. The article's closing paragraph suggests why. Let us remember, according to evolution, the uplifting of mountains took millions of years. Remember, fossils are at every stage of marine life, from days old to full-grown whales, all mixed and destroyed together, then embedded into softer rock, limestone, as into mud. It happened very quickly, not in millions or thousands or even hundreds of years. No, in a matter of days. And remember, fossilized sea life lies upon every major mountain range on Earth, even thousands of feet above sea level. Slow-moving plates and melting glaciers do not do that. It was a worldwide catastrophic event, a worldwide flood to be exact. If there's not enough water on Earth to cover Mount Ararat's 16,854-foot summit, then, of course, there's not enough water to cover Mount Everest. So how did marine fossils end up on top of every mountain range on Earth? Last century, when I was in grade school, my teachers, using the uniformitarian principle, explained why the Rocky Mountains were higher than the Appalachian Mountains. The Rockies were newer, but over the next several million years or so, wood erode and weather like the Appalachians. Although taught with certainty, was what I learned in grade school an accurate description of Earth's geology? Not according to the Bible. The Bible totally contradicts this secular worldview. What did Peter say about how most people would reject the evidence of how the flood changed the earth? 2 Peter 3:3-6. This is from the Good News Translation. 2 Peter 3:3. First of all, you must understand that in the last days, some people will appear whose lives are controlled by their own lusts. They will make fun of you and me and ask, he promised to come, didn't he? Well, where is he? Our ancestors have already died, but everything is the same as it was since the creation of the world. They purposefully ignore the fact that long ago, God gave a command and the heavens and earth were created. The earth was formed out of water and by water. And it was also by water, which water? The water of the flood, that the old world was destroyed. Verse 6 is a key verse to understanding how present mountain ranges have marine fossils. The floodwaters didn't have to cover the earth as it exists today. It had to cover the pre-flood earth, which looked nothing like what we see today. Here's some comments from an article, Did Noah's Flood Cover the Himalayan Mountains? The flood accomplished abundant geologic work, eroding sediments here, redepositing them there, pushing up continents, elevating plateaus, denuding terrains, etc., so that the earth today is quite different than before. Mount Everest and the Himalayan range, along with the Alps, the Rockies, the Appalachians, the Andes, and most of the world's other mountains are composed of ocean bottom sediments full of marine fossils laid down by the flood. Mount Everest itself has clam fossils at the summit. The article reasons, at the end of the flood, after thick sequences of sediments had accumulated, the Indian subcontinent evidently collided with Asia, crumpling the sediments into mountains. Today, they stand as giants, folded in fractured layers of ocean bottom sediments at high elevations. Noah's flood didn't cover the Himalayas, it formed them. Is that wishful thinking by the author, or does the Bible support that belief? What words does the New Testament use when describing Noah's flood? The Greek word kataklysmos, a noun, and kataklyso, a verb, Strong's 2627 and 2626. In English, both words mean cataclysm. Merriam-Webster defines cataclysm as a momentous and violent event marked by overwhelming upheaval and demolition, an event that brings great changes. Of all the events, past and future, mentioned in the New Testament, only the Noahian flood is described using these two words for cataclysm. Is that consistent with Old Testament references to the flood? Psalm 104, 6 through 9, "You covered the earth with oceans, the water was above the mountains. But at your command, the waters rushed away. When you gave your orders, like thunder, it hurried away." Verse 8, "The mountains rose, the valleys sank. The water went to places you made for it. You set borders for the seas that they cannot cross. The water will never cover the earth again." The Henry Morris Study Bible observes regarding verse 7, "The words fled and hasted or rushed indicate very rapid drainage, implying much geological work being done. Verse 8 states, the mountains rise, the basins sink. This post-flood mountain building period permitted the floodwaters to drain off into new ocean basins. The Genesis account of the flood also testifies to the cataclysmic nature of the flood. Chapter 7, verse 11. "When Noah was 600 years old, on the 17th day of the second month, all the outlets of the vast body of water beneath the earth burst open. All the floodgates of the sky opened." The contemporary English version states, "The water under the earth started gushing out everywhere." The New Living Translation reads, "All the underground waters erupted from below the earth." The verb translated burst forth, gushing, and erupted is Strong's 1234, Baca. Old Testament authors used Baca 51 times, always with a context of destruction and ferocity. When describing nature, Baca is associated with geologic activity, as in Numbers 16:31, when the earth split open, Baca, under Korah, and Zechariah 14:4, when the Mount of Olives split apart, Baca, forming a huge valley. Here is how the Henry Morris Study Bible explains the fountains of the Great Deep. The physical cause of the flood is clearly identified as the eruption of the waters in the great deep and the opening of the floodgates of heaven. These are quite sufficient in themselves to cause and explain all the phenomena of the flood. The pre-flood water cycle was apparently controlled by a system of subterranean pressurized reservoirs and conduits, but these fountains were all cleaved open in one day, releasing tremendous quantities of water and magma to the earth's surface. and dust and gas into the atmosphere. The resulting combination of atmospheric turbulence and dust was probably the immediate cause of the precipitation of the vapor canopy. The cataclysmic restoration of the primeval deep that resulted left the pre-flood world completely devastated and inundated. Is there enough water on Earth today to submerge the post-flood 16,854-foot tall Mount Ararat? No. But was there enough water on Earth in Noah's day? Unequivocally. What did 2 Peter 3:6 say? The world that then was being overflowed with water perished. What did Psalm 104:8 say about geologic changes during the flood? The mountains rose, the valleys sank, the water went to places you made for it. Why would God cause mountains and valleys and deep ocean troughs to form? Verse 9 of Psalm 104. You set borders for the seas, they cannot cross. The water will never cover the earth again. With those geologic changes, God made it impossible for another global flood to occur. God has kept and will keep his promise in Genesis 9, there will never again be a flood to destroy the earth. Why is it important for us to understand details surrounding Noah and a global flood? Because without belief in the first chapters of the Bible, it's impossible to have a biblical worldview, and it's easy to be deceived that the Bible isn't true. We are constantly being bombarded with anti-biblical lies and must counter them with knowledge of the Bible. UCG.org has many articles and sermons about the truth of the flood. And if you're interested, I suggest you start with the article, Noah's Ark, Was It Possible? The Henry Morris Study Bible makes the general observation about today. Evolutionary uniformitarianism completely dominates the scientific and educational establishments of every nation today. It has been made the basic premise of origins and meanings, not only in science and history, but also in social sciences, humanities, fine arts, and practically every discipline of study and practice in the world. How much of an impact has such a desensitizing disinformation campaign accomplished? Much. Sadly, according to the Cultural Research Center, even professing Christians reject the Bible and therefore the account of Noah. The Cultural Research Center has found that only 37% of Christian pastors have a biblical worldview and only 6% of their congregants. Gallup, in its latest values and beliefs survey conducted in May, got similar results. Gallup found that a new high of 29% say the Bible is a collection of fables, legends, and moral precepts as recorded by man. So when even professing Christians don't believe the Bible, is it any wonder that mockers of the Bible abound today? According to secular worldview, mankind has evolved over centuries from barely functioning brutes to the highly intelligent people of today. According to biblical worldview, mankind was created fully developed and genetically perfect and has devolved into what we are today. Did ancient man have the wherewithal to build the ark? Absolutely. Man was created with intelligence and given long life to pursue sweeping knowledge and masterful skills. The means by which post-flood structures were built, like Puma Punku and Göbekli Tepe, baffle and challenge the brightest minds of today. Using comparable building techniques, Noah constructed a vessel capable of withstanding the forces of violent waves from the most destructive flood in history. both the Old Testament and the New Testament refer very specifically to the flood as a cataclysm which brought about great changes on the earth. Devastation, formation of mountain ranges, origination of valleys and canyons. The post-flood world of today looks nothing like the pre-flood world of Noah. Uniformitarians would have us believe the present is the key to the past, when in fact the truth is the past is the key to the present. Mockers of Noah and of a global flood have many objections to the events depicted in the Bible, but all of their objections have rational answers. Why? Because the account of Noah and of a global flood is actual history recorded by men inspired by God, who was an eyewitness to those events. The Bible warns us that scoffers and skeptics don't want truthful answers to their positions because they're obstinate and have intentionally chosen to believe theories of men rather than the truth of God. Paul encountered similar thinking in his day. The advice he gave then is just as relevant as it is today. 1 Timothy 4, verses 7 and 8, in the easy-to-read version, counsels, "People tell silly stories that don't agree with God's truth. Don't follow what those stories teach, but teach yourself to be devoted to God. Training your body helps in some ways, but devotion to God helps in every way. It brings you blessings in this life and in the future life, too."